Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Surgical Care Improvement Project Odd Failure Initiative conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone requires assistance during the conference, please press star then zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Ms. Denise Faulkner Cameron. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Shannon, and thank you all for joining us for today's Surgical Care Improvement Project Heart Failure Initiative conference call. Today's topic of discussion is the SCIP-CAR2 indicator, which is looking at the proportion of surgical patients that are on a beta blocker prior to admission who received the beta blocker during the perioperative period. And we're pleased to once again feature the team as well as one of their clinical champions in anesthesia from the St. Francis Hospital, which is a designated heart center in Roslyn, Long Island. And they have worked closely with us during the previous scope of work on the Surgical Care Improvement Project, and they have graciously agreed to be a mentoring hospital for our hospitals in New York State that are currently focusing on this initiative. Before we begin today's call, I just want to give all those who have not yet had an opportunity to access the materials to log on to Jenny to access them, and the address for Jenny is jeny.ipro.org. And once you reach the Jenny homepage, scroll down to the discussion topic forum and click on IPRO QIO initiatives for the ninth scope of work. And then click on the Skip Heart Failure Initiative link. And the second link is entitled Skip Heart Failure Conference Call Materials for today's date, April 28, 2009. When you click on that, it'll bring you to the thread with all of today's materials, which includes an agenda outlining the format of the call, the two presentations that we're going to have from Dr. Segal, as well as the team, as well as some supporting documentation that the team is going to take us through later on today. So the first slide set that we're going to follow is entitled Dr. Segal Beta Blocker Update. And at this time, we're going to go right into Dr. Segal's presentation. But before I hand the call over to him, I just want to give you a little information about his background. Dr. Segal is currently the Director of Perioperative Medicine and Endoscopic Anesthesia at St. Francis Hospital. He received his medical degree from Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York and completed his residency in anesthesiology at the Yale University School of Medicine. He is currently certified by the American Board of Anesthesiologists and the National Board of Medical Examiners, and he is also board certified in advanced cardiac life support and basic life support. Dr. Segal's affiliations include the American Society of Anesthesiologists, the New York State Society of Anesthesiologists, the International Anesthesia Research Society, and the Society of Cardiovascular Anesthesiologists. So it is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Eugene Segal.
Denise, thank you very much for your introduction, and I hope everyone can hear me clearly. The slides that I'm going to be going over, I hope you have access to, and I'll do my best to, in some of the more complex slides, since I don't know exactly what's being visible and not to the participants, I'll do my best to describe exactly what is there. I figured a good spot for me to start in, other than you just heard a little bit about what my background is to tell you a little bit about how I became involved in this issue of beta blockers. And it goes back to my training at Yale New Haven Hospital, where I was very fortunate to be there in the early 90s. And the acting chairman at the time was Paul Barish, who is considered one of the grandfathers of cardiac anesthesia. Also, at that time, one of the junior attendings was somebody by the name of Lee Fleischer, who has pioneered a lot of this work, and in the early 90s developed the first set of guidelines for the American College of Cardiology with regards to preoperative evaluation of patients, cardiac patients, for non-cardiac surgery. He then went on to do a lot of publications in the role of beta blockers for minimizing cardiac morbidity in the perioperative period, and most recently has been the lead author in the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association guidelines with preoperative evaluations, including beta blockade. As you heard, I'm a working anesthesiologist at St. Francis Hospital, which serves the New York, Long Island area with a primary focus on cardiac patients, but we do a lot more than just open heart surgery, since we see a lot of our open heart patients later present for non-cardiac surgery. So this is a topic that we see with great frequency here at St. Francis Hospital. My talk is labeled beta blocker update, and the reason it's called an update is because this particular topic is in a great deal of flux right now, and I'm going to do my best to give you a little bit of background as to what beta blockers are, present a little bit of what the literature has shown, and how this topic has changed a little bit and is, in my opinion, going to continue to change in the next couple of years. So I'm going to start with my slides. First slide, number two, beta blockers. They're essentially a class of drugs used to treat cardiac arrhythmias, cardioprotection, and hypertension. We're going to focus on the roles on cardioprotection or preventing ischemia, myocardial infarction, and cardiac death from surgical procedures. Propranolol was the first clinically useful beta blocker, which was invented by Sir James W. Black, who later won the Nobel Prize in 1988 for his work. Throughout the human body, there are presently three distinct beta receptors, beta 1, beta 2, and beta 3, and we're going to focus primarily on the beta 1 receptors, which are found in both the heart and the kidneys. Beta 1 receptors induce a positive chronotropic and inotropic effect on the heart. They also induce renin release in the kidney. But with regards to what we're focusing on, the positive chronotropic effect reflects an increase in heart rate, and a positive inotropic effect reflects increased contractility in the heart. Next slide, number three. So with the action of beta blockers, we're blocking down on these beta 1 receptors, and we are decreasing the force or contractility of the heart, and we're also decreasing heart rate. At the same time, as we said before, it also decreases renin release in the kidneys. But by decreasing both force and heart rate, we are decreasing the oxygen consumption of the heart, or decreasing the workload of the heart, which is one of its thought to be main benefits. Next slide just so shows a chemical depiction of the first beta blocker that was clinically used, propranolol. Next slide is quite a complex slide, and I'm going to not spend a lot of time, but it's there to highlight a number of different issues. There's many uses of beta blockers. There's many adverse effects. There's many different types of beta blockers. There's certain beta blockers that have effects just on the beta 1 receptors of the heart. There are certain beta blockers that have effects on both beta 2 and beta 3. And a lot of these beta blockers, even though may look similar at first, have subtle differences that when we look later into the studies that have shown differences, it's very important to keep in mind what beta blockers have been used in which studies. And if you look in particular to metoprolol, which is on the lower right-hand corner of the slide, and I don't know if you can see this or not, but one of the things that's interesting about metoprolol is it tells you that it has a delayed effect. So the full effect of this particular beta blocker may not be achieved for at least 1 to 2 weeks after the initiation of this particular medication. Other beta blockers may have immediate effects. Next slide, six. So reduction of cardiac events by beta blockers. How does this happen? The mechanism is still unclear, although we have fairly clear indications on what the theoretical advantages of using beta blockers are. Improved myocardial oxygen balance, as we talked about before, they decrease both heart rate and contractility, thereby decreasing the work that the heart has to do, and it decreases the oxygen consumption. It actually has not only a decrease in consumption of oxygen, but may actually increase the oxygen delivery of the heart. And the way that this happens is that by decreasing heart rate, we increase the time that the heart actually spends in its relaxed diastolic state. And by decreasing heart rate and increasing the time that it spends in diastole, diastole is the time where coronary circulation is maximized. By decreasing heart rate, we can actually increase the amount of oxygen delivery to the heart. So it's one of the few drugs out there that physiologically not only decrease oxygen consumption, but increase oxygen delivery to the heart. It also has effects on metabolism and may have a suppression of lipolysis. It affects the way fatty acids versus glucose is metabolized within the heart, which is also thought to be one of the mechanisms of cardiac protection. The other issue that came up when we started seeing that beta blockers were good for the heart, people started saying, well, we have a host of other drugs like calcium channel blockers and other drugs that decrease heart rate. Why aren't these drugs as good as beta blockers thought to be when it comes to cardiac protection? And these next two mechanisms are what comes into play. The beta blockers seem to stabilize the coronary atherosclerotic plaque. And as I will show you in just a moment, this is felt to be one of the main dangers when patients come for surgery, is that you may not have a situation where you have a very chronic, stable atherosclerotic plaque that has narrowed down on the coronary artery, but you may have somebody who's asymptomatic out there that may just have a little bit of a plaque that narrows the coronary artery by, let's say, 20%, but it's just hanging in the breeze and it's susceptible to breaking off, going down the coronary artery where it gets narrower and narrower, and then you have an area of myocardium that has an acute occlusion that hasn't seen any type of reduction on coronary blood flow and has any type of time frame or chronicity to develop collateral circulation. Next slide. So again, why are beta blockers beneficial? The top picture shows that plaque that I was just talking about where you see still the coronary artery is not really narrowed tremendously, but you have all this fibrin and atherosclerotic buildup that is prone to break off. Now, why does this happen during surgery? Why is it such a danger during patients coming for high-risk surgery? Is that when patients come for surgery, we have a stress response that the human body responds to that has two things. One is we have an activation of the sympathetic nervous system that increases heart rate, increases blood pressure, and also has effects on vasospasm. It has effects on the coagulation profile of that patient, and it has platelet activation. So these patients are not only being placed under stress because their hearts are working harder from a sympathetic activation standpoint, but these patients also tend to be hypercoagulable during the perioperative period. So if you have an area that's narrowed or has atherosclerotic buildup in it, you're begging for further platelet aggregation there, and a recipe that's doomed for potentially bad things to happen. Next slide shows a host of different beta blocker studies, and what you see are the lead authors on the left, and the numbers next to the names include how many patients were presented in those particular studies. There's an odds ratio here. So basically what this slide shows, and we're in slide number 8 now, is that if you have an odds ratio of 1 in a study, then beta blockers were no better and control was no better. So it's an equivalent response between patients that were on a beta blocker versus control. If the yellow dots fall towards the left of an odds ratio 1, those particular studies showed that beta blockers were beneficial for patients. And if your yellow dots fell to the right of an odds ratio 1, it showed that the control was better than the beta blockers were in that particular study. what you see from here is you see different degrees, but most of our studies, except for one clearly here of Jacobson, shows that beta blockers are beneficial for patients coming for surgery, and it tends to minimize the cardiac morbidity and mortality from perioperative procedures. Next slide, number 9. This is probably one of the earliest, most cited articles with regards to cardiac protection from beta blockade. It's a study out of the University of California, San Francisco by Dennis Mangano that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1996. He developed a center that just was dedicated to research, and that's what's the title up on the top of the slide. It's the Multicenter Study of Perioperative Ischemia Research. And what they did, and this study was done at a VA hospital in San Francisco, they took 200 general surgery patients. They randomized these 200 patients to a combination of either oral or intravenous atenolol versus placebo. So half their patients got atenolol, and this was immediately preoperatively, meaning within 2 to 4 hours prior to the surgery. Half their patients got atenolol, the other group got placebo. And these patients received their atenolol for 7 days postoperatively. What they found, interestingly enough, is that they didn't find a statistical difference in regards to perioperative myocardial infarctions or death, but they did see about a 50% decrease in the episodes of ischemia that were being registered by patients on Holter monitoring. And they thought that perhaps if their number of patients had been greater than just 200, there certainly would have been a statistical difference with regards to perioperative infarction and death in these patients. So much less ischemia in the atenolol group versus the placebo group. And interestingly enough, this is one of the few studies that not only looked at patients within the hospital setting, but they followed their patients for approximately 2 years postoperatively. And they saw a dramatic decrease in the death of these patients when they followed them postoperatively within the 6-month period as well as within the 2-year period, where there was a tenfold decrease in the death rate in patients that had received atenolol during their perioperative period. The next slide that really totally changed, and this happened more or less at the same time that SCIF got involved with different institutions, is a study out of the Netherlands by Dr. Poldermans. And this was published in New England Journal of Medicine in 1999. This was a very elegant study that could probably not have taken place in the United States, but I'll just briefly go over some of the highlights. I'm going to backtrack actually for just one moment because I think it's important to understand the subtle differences in these studies because you're going to see conflicting data. Going back to the study that I just showed you before on Mangano's, one of the criticisms that comes about from the literature about that study is A, that it was only 200 patients, but also there were 9 perioperative deaths in that study. Those 9 patients were not included as part of their study, and some people criticized that study that their results may have been different if those patients had been included in the study. So going back here now to Dr. Poldermans, what they did is they looked at a different type of beta blocker. This is bisoprolol, which is also a beta-1 selected beta blocker, on high-risk patients undergoing vascular surgery. What they did is they took 846 patients with risk factors for cardiac disease, and out of these 846 patients, they took all 846 and they gave them all dobutamine stress echoes. So now they found that out of the 846, 173 of them were found to have new regional wall motion abnormalities on their stress echoes. So these were very high-risk patients, not because only of their risk factors, but they now underwent a test that said, hey, not only do we think, we know these patients are having abnormal studies on their stress test. Out of the 173, they did exclude 61 patients because they had extremely large areas of regional wall motion abnormalities, and they felt that it would be unethical for these patients to be randomized and not have further cardiac workup before their vascular surgery or high-risk surgery. So we still have over 100 patients that we know are at very high risk for cardiac disease undergoing high-risk surgery. And what they did then is they randomized these patients to either standard care. These are patients then that were not on beta blockers, and we said, okay, we're going to continue their medical therapy, or we're going to start them on a beta blocker. Another important difference between this study and Mangano, like we talked about before, Mangano started their beta blocker immediately in the holding area, 2 to 4 hours preoperatively. Bisoprolol here was started at least 7 days prior to surgery, and another important distinction here is they titrated the amount of beta blocker that they were giving to titrate it to a heart rate. So they needed a heart rate less than 60 preoperatively and less than 80 intra-op. So this is one of the few studies that doesn't just give a random or fixed dose of beta blocker. They titrated the beta blockade to a heart rate response, and like I said, was initiated at least 7 days prior to surgery. And like we talked about before, in the slide that I showed you, that very complex slide looking at different beta blockers, we now know that certain beta blockers take at least a week to have a full effect, to have a cardioprotective effect. So these are all different things that play into the results depending on what beta blocker was used in which study. What Polderman's study showed, if they looked at just cardiac death, there was a 3.4% versus a 17% difference in death. And if you looked at non-fatal MIs, there was a 0% versus 17% lower for the bisoprolol group. So if you combine both cardiac death and non-fatal MI, you were talking about a risk reduction of tenfold, of 3.4% versus 34% lower for bisoprolol. And this really revolutionized. Everyone had to really pay strict attention, and what came out of this, it was to take all comers. They said beta blockers are so cardioprotective that these numbers are better than if we had taken the same patient and sent them either to have open heart surgery or to have angioplasty. We're better off just having patients be put on beta blockers, that their reduction in cardiac risk was better by beta blockade than any other thing out there. And certainly with regards to a cost perspective, it was a very enticing way to decrease cost and maximize or lower the cardiac perioperative morbidity. Next, slide 11, history of SCIB. Obviously, the initiative here is to reduce postoperative mortality and morbidity by 25% over 5 years. Next slide. This was more or less at the time when Polderman studies out, and this is what SCIB had recommended with regards to beta blockade, that we should use perioperative beta blockade on vascular patients, okay, and continue perioperative beta blockade for patients on beta blocker therapy. This has recently changed, and I will show you mainly the reason in the study where the change has come about, but these were basically came out of the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. After Polderman's study and a revision in 2007 of both of these guidelines, where we said there's just too much compelling data and there was class one evidence to support that we needed to continue perioperative beta blockade on patients, but also on patients who were not on beta blockers coming for high-risk surgery like vascular surgery, that there was enough class one evidence that we should start these patients on beta blockers. This highlights, next slide, slide 13, shows a slide where we're looking on the y-axis, the cumulative mortality percentage-wise, versus the x-axis being a time frame. So the lowest, the light blue graph shows patients that were on beta blockers coming for surgery. If we did nothing but just continue their beta blockade, they tended to do pretty well. The next group is the green, and these are patients that we started on beta blockers. So these are patients that were not on beta blockers that we now started beta blockers, and they tended to do pretty well as well. The yellow part of the graph shows non-users. So patients who came for surgery who were not on beta blockers, that we did not initiate beta blockade, they tended to do slightly worse, but not too bad, not too different, but certainly worse than the other two groups. But what was striking in looking at the data is the red graph. And the red graph represents patients that were on beta blockers preoperatively that had disruption of the beta blockade and came for surgery. You saw a dramatic increase on the mortality and morbidity of these patients, which is why it has become so important to continue beta blockers perioperatively. Next, slide 14. This is a study that was published in Lancet in 2008 called the POISE trial that really changed the way we use beta blockers today. Next, slide 15. POISE trial, or POISE, stands for perioperative ischemic evaluation. This was a study done in Canada by Devereaux et al., like I said, published in Lancet of 2008, and this is a very large study, much larger than any of the other studies that we saw. It's multi-center. They included over 8,000 patients here. It was blinded and randomized, unlike our other two studies that we saw. And what they compared was metoprolol versus placebo. Metoprolol, mind you, is the study that I showed you in that complex slide that takes about 1 to 2 weeks to have a full effect, okay, versus placebo. What they measured was cardiovascular events during a 30-day postoperative period. So the cardiovascular events that they were measuring were cardiac death, a non-fatal myocardial infarction, and non-fatal cardiac arrest. The first dose of metoprolol that was given, which was 100 milligrams, was given 2 to 4 hours before surgery. So unlike the Polderman study, but like the Atenolol study of Mangano, these were given acutely in the preoperative setting. Metoprolol was then continued at 200 milligrams per day for 30 days. Now what did they see? They saw that metoprolol patients were 27% less likely to suffer an MI, which is a good thing and an expected result. But what they found that really stirred up a tremendous amount of controversy that we're still trying to sort out is that the metoprolol patients were 33% more likely to die and twice as likely to suffer a stroke. So many people out there said, all right, it's great that we're saving them a heart attack, but we're killing off a tremendous number more patients than we would have if we had not done the study. And it actually, this study ended up being stopped early when they started seeing the results that were here. So what do we make of this? Like I have pointed out previously, I want to point out certain of the deficiencies of this study. This was not like the Polderman study that they basically titrated the amount of beta blocker to a heart rate. They basically gave the same dose, like I said, first dose being metoprolol 100 milligrams, and it didn't matter what your heart rate response was to that, and it didn't matter whether you were a 75-pound woman or a 300-pound male, that you received the same dose of beta blockade. These doses also that they included in their studies, depending on what you read, whether it's the PDR or other studies, are anywhere from 2 to 8 times the recommended doses of these drugs. And a lot of the literature says that you should heed their results carefully because they certainly may have something to do with having more hypotension, more bradycardia, which led to these strokes and deaths in their studies. However, very difficult to ignore this study because of 8,000 patients on an otherwise very well done study. Next slide shows, I don't know how well you can see this, but this is the slides from their publications. And if we look at the slides here, the green lines reflect the metoprolol group, the red lines reflect placebo. And if you look at the top right-hand slide, you see that the metoprolol group has a lower risk of myocardial infarction. That's what that slide's looking at. But when we look at slides C and D that look at stroke and death, you see how the metoprolol group, or the green line, outpaced their placebo group in regards to both stroke and death. Next slide. So their conclusion in Lancet said that current perioperative guidelines that recommend beta blocker therapy to patients undergoing non-cardiac surgery should reconsider their recommendations in light of these findings. Next slide. The difficulty in comparing these studies. So now what do we do with our patients coming for surgery? The only thing that now Skip looks at is continuing beta blockade, because that is presently, even though the ACC guidelines have not yet been revised, they are in the process of being revised, that's probably going to be the only class 1 indication for beta blockers in the perioperative period. The pitfalls with all these studies, and what do we make of them, is that there's no uniformity to any of these studies. Dosing withdrawal is certainly an issue that we have talked about. All these patients that we're looking at are patients who are naked to beta blockers. None of these patients, other than the withdrawal studies, these are patients who have not been on beta blockers. They have all used different beta blockers, or a lot of them have used different beta blockers that may come into play with regards to how they function and how protective they are. The timing of beta blockers prior to surgery, certainly like we saw in Polderman, he started his patient a week prior to, and they were titrated, as opposed to the other studies that were given their beta blockers 2 to 4 hours immediately preoperatively. It's particularly important, with, like we said, with certain beta blockers, that they take not only a week to have a full effect, but this inflammation and plaque stability that we talked about this vulnerable plaque that leads to a lot of our patients having myocardial infarction in the perioperative period, that it may take, even on a beta blocker that has an acute reaction, it doesn't take a full week to have a full effect. That type of physiologic response, patients may need to be on beta blockers for a longer period of time. Longer period of time meaning at least a few days. And we have also discovered over time that there's different genotypes with regards to how certain subsets of patients respond to beta blockers. Next slide. So limitations, these are all limitations in the perioperative beta blocker literatures. Most trials are inadequately powered, meaning they have too few patients to make their significance felt, other than the POI study. Few randomized trials of medical therapy to prevent perioperative major adverse cardiac events. The studies to determine the role of beta blockers in intermediate or low-risk patients are very lacking. Most of these studies that I have shown you are high-risk patients for high-risk surgery. Studies to determine the optimal type of beta blocker are lacking. Like I said, they all use different beta blockers. And no studies have addressed care delivery mechanisms, identifying how, when, and by whom perioperative beta blocker therapy should be implemented. So what do we do? How do we make it through this this mumbo-jumbo of all this literature, and what do we do with our patients? I can tell you that speaking to the present experts right now in the field, they certainly don't want people and clinicians to abandon the use of beta blockers. Beta blockers have been found to be extremely beneficial, but we have to be careful about who and how we give these drugs to our patients. So certainly we should continue beta blockers on patients currently taking them, and certainly consider starting beta blockers on high-risk patients or vascular patients presenting for high-risk surgery, taking into account that we should titrate these drugs to an effect and continue these drugs in the postoperative setting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Segal, for that comprehensive overview of beta blockers for surgical patients. And at this time, I'm going to turn the call over to Maureen Gauss and her team, who's going to talk to us about the hospital's best practices as it relates to this measure. And for the purposes of those who are following via your computer screen on Jenny, the title of the slide set that Ms. Goss is going to talk about is entitled IPRO Presentation Beta Blockers, April 28, 2009. I turn it over to Maureen Gauss now. Go ahead, Maureen.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Maureen Goss from the Performance Improvement Department at St. Francis. Other members of our department who are with us today are Anna Baricini, ABP with PI, and Kathy Arnoff, one of our PI nurses who abstracts measures for the SCIP. As I don't know which of our listeners heard our last presentation, I will review a little about St. Francis Hospital and our core measure process as I did in the last presentation. It's important to know the concepts behind our actions with all the core measures. Slide 3. St. Francis Hospital was founded in 1922 by the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary for children with rheumatic heart disease. We are a member of Catholic Health Services of Long Island and carry out the healing ministry of the church and the Diocese of Rockville Center. Our mission is built upon our heritage, always emphasizing respect for the dignity of individuals and the compassionate treatment for all. The spirit of people who work at St. Francis is unique. We are fortunate to have a close group of caregivers at St. Francis, many of whom have lifetime careers here. Caregivers are vested to seeing us succeed in providing excellent patient care. Keeping our patients as the most important focus, doing right by the patient is always number one. St. Francis Hospital is a magnet-recognized facility known for patient care excellence. We are also recognized as one of the best places to work in New York. United States, U.S. News and World Report recognized us as a leader in cardiac care, digestive disorders, and geriatrics. We are New York State's only specialty-designated cardiac center and offer one of the leading cardiac care programs in the nation, with specialties in heart surgery, cardiac catheterization, and angioplasty, and the diagnosis and treatment of abnormal heart rhythm. St. Francis has the latest technology for non-invasive diagnostic imaging and minimally invasive surgery, plus expanding programs in vascular, prostate, ear, nose, and throat, orthopedic, and general surgery. We are not just the heart center anymore. St. Francis also has a comprehensive program in community health and education based at the DeMatteis Center for Cardiac Research and Education. Slide 4. St. Francis Hospital has had tremendous growth over the past year. Our new DeMatteis building expanded clinical space by 40%. We expanded our cardiac cath labs, ORs, critical care beds, and emergency room. St. Francis has a non-teaching structure where nursing communicates directly with the attending, and mid-level practitioners assist the attending. We do have students in other disciplines such as nursing and the technologies. Slide 5, and there's an attachment about Deming's 14 points. I included Deming's 14 points again with this presentation as these concepts are consistent with what we aim to do with our core measures. We want to build quality into our process, drive out fear so people will talk, and do better jobs with leadership support. Leaders promoting core measures within the hospital help people pay attention. Our PI department requested additional staff to complete our increasing core measure abstraction, follow-up, and data integrity checks, and receive this staff as they are roles valued by leadership. We have physician champions for all our core measures and have two anesthesiologists for SCIP, Dr. Eugene Segal for SCIP beta blockers and Dr. Steven Shulman for the rest of SCIP. Our VP of Medical Affairs, Dr. Jack Sotorakis, also supports us having a monthly article in the medical newsletter and speaking at mandatory physician meetings, physician orientations, and smaller departmental meetings. We report to support services, hospital PI, departmental meetings, and the medical PI committees. Core measures are woven throughout our work in the hospital. We work with multidisciplinary teams as everyone's role is important. The PI department, Performance Improvement Department, manages core measures at St. Francis Hospital. We meet as needed weekly and monthly. Slide 6, communication is a key point. We need to find ways to increase awareness of core measure indicators. Word messages differently for different caregivers. What should each group focus on? We need to reach and provide faster feedback to all those involved with the OFI, which is the Opportunity for Improvement. Emailing works very well with us. Many of us use work and personal email. Another key concept is building trust with staff who have various concepts of core measures and the changing healthcare environment. Caregivers are adjusting to the idea of the government grading their care based on documentation. Care is done, patient does well, but if it's not documented and not documented with specific words, they don't get the credit. We've found significant increase in understanding with our practitioners when they understand that the push for higher quality and best practices is behind these regulations. Having well-respected physician leaders, and staff help the caregivers trust what you are trying to do. You also need to understand the workload of the staff. The last thing they want to hear about is documentation, but the best ideas come from those within the system. Think positive and be non-punitive, another Deming point, so that people will be more receptive and offer explanations and ways to improve. Slide 7, some fluctuation in compliance is normal. Check for trends and outliers. Don't give up on actions because of a dip. What else is affecting what you are doing? How can you adjust actions and increase education? Maybe actions are not in place as you think they are. Change is not always immediate. We need to break habits, reach all the players, reinforce, and build change into the system. Maintain a focus on data integrity. Our core measure RNs attend educational WebExes by our vendor Midas, double-check OFI charts as part of a PI plan, and have in-office meetings with each other to document, standardize, and improve our abstraction, follow-up, and education. We need to document our own actions for improvement. We educate ourselves and others and need to reach out further to physicians and nursing throughout hospital CE days and orientations. Slide 8. The PI department manages core measures at St. Francis. Staff focus on one core measure and are cross-trained in another for backup. We do a retrospective review of a sample of charts chosen by our vendor Midas, which provides us with excellent support and education. Our core measure nurses abstract the charts, enter the information into Midas, pull OFI, Opportunity for Improvement reports, from Midas, and talk to whomever they need to talk to regarding these OFIs. We do a targeted, concurrent review of AMI and CHF patients, only for what we can affect and only for those patients we can identify. Slide 9. We started submitting data for the SCIP perioperative beta blocker indicator in January 2007. As you can see from the attached graph, which is at the end of this PowerPoint in slide 19, we have shown improvement since that time. At the time this indicator began, clinical research pointed to first determining patient risk before considering beta blockers. Our anesthesiologist used a beta blocker assessment form, which is also included with your handout, and the title on that handout is Cardiac Risk Reduction Perioperative Beta Adrenergic Blockade Protocol, the long title, which is, so you know up front, we no longer use this form. Back then, anesthesiologists would assess the patient according to the cue questions on the form and choose beta blocker coverage as per the recommendations. We were fortunate to have both anesthesiologist leaders, Dr. Eugene Segal and Dr. Shulman, since this time period, and actually since the beginning that we were working with SCIP. Our leaders educated the anesthesiologists about SCIP, and we in the PI department sent memos and emails about the indicator. However, we discovered it was not clear to the anesthesiologists what we were measuring. On one hand, they had the clinical guidelines and St. Francis policy recommendations as noted on the beta blocker form, and on the other hand, were hearing much too frequently for any physician at the time about CMS's core measure guidelines, which were not the same. As abstractors, we noticed that charts fell out of compliance because they were documented to be not at risk according to the beta blocker form. The anesthesiologist checked off low risk but did not always document further, as they were not required to, why they chose not to give beta blockers. When the anesthesiologists were questioned, they knew the reasons why they would not give the beta blockers but did not document the reasons. Again, this is an example of good care but not backed by documentation. We received calls in the PI department questioning which procedures CMS considered high and low risk for beta blockers. We needed to clear up this confusion. To clarify which direction we were heading with beta blocker coverage, Dr. Segal discussed the issue with Dr. Stimler at IPRO. Dr. Stimler confirmed CMS decided not to look at all patients going for surgery, but to focus only on those who were on beta blockers prior to admission. We explained this focus to the anesthesiologist, but as long as we continued to use the beta blocker form, we had outliers because the form gave a different message. Dr. Segal decided to eliminate use of this form and incorporate any beta blocker prompts into the anesthesia OR record, which is included in your handout. The anesthesia record in your handout is the one with the grid. These actions were discussed in the third quarter of 07 and activated in the fourth quarter of 07. You can see on the compliance graph, which is the last graph on the PowerPoint, that our compliance rates rose significantly after these changes. Slide 10. The anesthesiologist decided to add a beta blocker section near the new antibiotic section on the top right of the OR form. In this section, they added beta blocker current med and last dose. The anesthesiologist decided they did not need a cue to document the contraindications, as that would normally follow from assessing for the beta blocker. They decided to document specific reasons in the notes section at the bottom right of the same form. The anesthesia OR form included in this presentation is our latest form. We have changed this form a number of times to address issues. For example, we noticed that some people were marking the last dose ordered instead of given, so we changed the words last dose to last dose given with date and time. The anesthesiologist changed the form in the manner that makes the most sense to them as users of the form. Slide 11. A few of our issues involved our medication reconciliation form, which the latest version is included with this presentation too, and that's a triplicate form. The title at the top does say medication reconciliation. We found some providers wrote discharge medications in the admissions section. So on page 1, where you see medications at admission, says home medication list, medication history, providers wrote, obviously in different handwriting and lower on the page, discharge medications, but did not label them as discharge medications. This affected our compliance when patients did not come into the hospital on beta blockers, but were discharged on beta blockers. We are very strict with our abstractions and had to take this obvious mistake as the patient being a yes for beta blocker current med. These patients would then often fall out of compliance. To follow up, we show these charts to the caregiver who wrote the medications in the wrong spot and also educate all providers not to write discharge medications in the admission medication section. Another issue with the medication reconciliation form is that the last dose, date, and or time is not documented. As you know, if you can prove the patient received the beta blocker dose within 24 hours prior to incision, the chart is in compliance. We have had a few instances when we could assume the patient had the dose, but the documentation did not support this. We show these charts to nursing during their quality improvement meetings and directly to the head nurse on the specific unit. Nursing leadership then educates their staff. We also write core measure corner articles for nursing that are included in the Nursing Did You Know newsletter, which is stapled to nursing paychecks. The medication reconciliation form will be revised again in the near future. Under the last dose column, we want to add two separate columns for date and time to trigger documentation of these items. One other nursing issue involves documenting around the midnight hour. This issue impacts many of our core measures. We understand that anyone working the night shift considers the shift as one time period. Some people thinking in that mode continue to write the previous day's date at and after the midnight hour, or change the date to the next date but write 2400, which actually refers to the following night. The doses are again obviously given at the appropriate time, but we have to abstract the chart as is rather than by intent. Sometimes this mistake can cause a perfect beta blocker dose to fall out of the acceptable time period. We follow these issues through with nursing, directly with a specific unit, and through the committees and by writing articles. Slide 12, more general issues and actions include emphasizing documenting contraindications. Most OFIs are not about the lack of appropriate care, but about documenting the thought process behind the excellent care. We need to educate and automate as much as possible. We use forms as a guide to help us keep up with changing regulations. Once a form is implemented, we have to follow through with ensuring the process is in place for these forms, which we've had a bit of experience with. We have form guides including physician letters, antibiotic guides and charts, core measure documentation form, and core measure cards. It is much easier and faster to access and change forms placed on the internet. Intranet forms have to be single-sided forms. Slides 13 and 14 review ways in which we reach out to our physicians and to nursing. We reach physicians through our physician leaders, by stapling bright orange letters inside chart covers and medical records, which prompts physicians to address missing items in their discharge summaries. This is more for the AMI and CHS core measures. We present at physician and mid-level practitioner meetings and orientations, write core measure corner articles in our monthly medical staff newsletter, review OFIs with our mid-level practitioner and physician leaders, who then follow through with the individual providers. We do targeted concurrent review to notify physicians for missing items, again, mainly with AMI and CHF. And we build backups into the system. No one is perfect. We need a system of checks. Although primary responsibility for many of the indicators is physicians, we need to provide backup catches. We reach nursing through the PI routinely discussing nursing-related issues with the nursing PI committees, writing core measure corner articles in the nursing newsletter, which is attached to paycheck, attending head nurse meetings to brainstorm why certain OFIs occur, talking with nurses on the floors, emailing nursing leaders for their insight on whom to contact and or how to address new issues, providing new monthly unit-based reports as a visual control influence. We always send quarterly reports but are trying to provide faster feedback to affect change. Slide 16 names some of our resources, which include our anesthesiologists, especially with the SCIP core measure, St. Francis Hospital team, Midas, our vendor, Dr. Dale Bratzler, who provides us excellent information on the SCIP blog and also through emailing, and the SCIP blog site. We strongly encourage at least one person in each facility to join the SCIP listserv to keep a finger on the pulse of what is going on, not only with SCIP, but with other core measures throughout the United States. Thank you.
And thank you, Maureen, and thank you to your team. At this time, we just are a few minutes from the top of the hour, but if it's okay with everyone, we will definitely stay on the line to take some questions. So at this time, Shannon, could you please give our audience instructions on how to submit a question if they so choose?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. One moment, please, for our first question. Our first question comes from Michelle Pollack with Lawrence Hospital. You may begin.
Hi, we were just wondering where the SCIP listserv can be found so we can sign up for it.
Hi, this is Denise from IPRO. We have the instructions that we can send. It's a link that I can send to you with instructions on how to sign up. I can actually just send it out to the whole group. I usually do it on an individual basis, but if the consensus is that everyone would like to join, I will just send it out to my whole list, the SCIP listserv. I do have to warn you, it can get pretty busy, and you might get several emails in a given day.
That's okay. Thank you, Denise.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. Our next question comes from Donna Warshatsky with Richmond University Medical Center. You may begin.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask you actually two questions. How many beds do you have?
369.
And, well, actually, it's two more questions. Do you sample or do you do 100%?
We sample.
You sample. And how many abstractors do you have?
For all the core measures or for SCIP?
Oh, for all the core measures. Well, even, yeah, it's for all of them. You have a certain number for each area?
We have part-time people and full-time people and trying to build up still.
Okay. Just maybe you could tell me all, and then that would help.
What happens is that some of the nurses are involved in other PI activities, so we have to just figure out how many hours FTE.
About
2.7.
Do your abstractors actually, they do education, or you mean you break it down to other people doing education and that type of thing? And being on the floors, monitoring what's going on concurrently.
Well, one example, we have one nurse who's a 0.6, and she does AMI. She does targeted concurrent review on the floor, so she gets she does the sample of charts, which is about 30 a month, and then she gets a list of concurrent AMI patients and rounds on the floors every day looking for the LV assessment and for the ACE and ARBs and for the core measure documentation form.
Okay, so then actually you break it down for each measure. You have a specific nurse who may do some concurrent as well as sampling.
Yes, and very limited concurrent. It's like more of a target. What are they going? They're going after an LV assessment or a form. They're not looking at the whole chart because then that would be the 100% of the sample.
Yes.
If there's no concurrent.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Absolutely right. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your help.
Thank you. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Okay. Before we conclude the call for today, just a couple of updates for the group. Our next and final webinar that's part of the VTE study that we're doing with the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality will be held on May 28th at 11 a.m. That is the series that we're doing with Dr. Greg Maynard from the University of California and San Diego, and that is, again, Thursday, May 28th at 11 o'clock, and we will be bringing further information with regards to dial-in number registration, as registration is required for those webinars, as well as the webinar materials. Also, I'd just like to remind everyone that the most updated SCIP heart failure quarterly data reports went out yesterday. If you didn't receive yours for any reason, please contact me and let me know, as well as contacting me if you have any questions. And finally, I just wanted to remind everyone that including in your materials for today was an evaluation form for today's teleconference that we ask you to please just take a few minutes to fill out and give us your feedback, as it's greatly appreciated and it helps for planning future activities. Once again, I would like to thank Dr. Segal and the Quality Improvement Team at St. Francis for their talk with us today, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from them in the near future. We'll also be getting back to you with regards to the next conference call, the date for the next conference call for the SCIP initiative. So at this time, if there, I don't know, Shannon, could we just check one more time if there's a question that came in the last few minutes, please?
Sure. I'm still showing no questions at this time.
No questions at this time. Okay, so thank you again, everyone, for your participation, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation, and have a wonderful day.